One of the things I learned when I was young, not one of the things I was taught, but that I learned somehow, is how damaging anger is. I watched adults turn their anger on children, and I learned that anger was hurtful and destructive. I saw the anger of children turned on other children in the schoolyard and learned that anger was hurtful and destructive. I felt the anger of adults and children thrown at me when they perceived I had done something wrong, like broken something accidentally or forgotten to do something I was expected to do. And I learned that anger was hurtful and destructive, that anger was bad. And it became one of the uppermost goals in my life not to be like the angry people. I am luckier than many. For many people, children and adults, crushed under the anger of another, learn a different lesson. A crippling lesson. Not that anger is bad, but that they are bad. And that evolves into shame and depression and, understandably, anger. And having learned nothing about anger as an emotion, a value-neutral emotion, they let their anger escape in slow leaks of passive aggressiveness or explosions of rage. And then another crumples under that anger and the cycle continues, and we are all wounded by a weapon that could, if we understood it better, if we worked with it instead of trying to master or eliminate it, a weapon that could be turned into plowshares. Not always, but often. Will you kind of ponder that in your heart like Mary does while I turn to this morning's scripture from the Gospel according to Mark? Listen for a word that God would have you to receive today. From Mark, the 11th chapter, beginning in the 15th verse. Then they came to Jerusalem, and Jesus entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. He was teaching and saying, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations,' but you have made it a den of robbers?" And when the chief priests and the scribes heard it, they kept looking for a way to kill him, for they were afraid of him, because the whole crowd was spellbound by his teaching. Talk about anger. Now, some of you may know all that's involved in this scene, but some of you may need a little background, so let me provide a little bit. The space where Jesus was actually outside the inner temple, and it was called the Court of the Gentiles because Gentiles were allowed to enter into that space, but they couldn't go further into the temple. So there is an understanding from our historical study that there was a great deal of corruption in this practice of bringing animals in for sacrifice. First, understand that in order to have their sins forgiven, the Jews believed that an appropriate sacrifice of a living thing was necessary. So they sacrificed sheep, doves, other animals in this ritual sacrifice. Actually, they handed them over to the priest to be sacrificed. Unfortunately, history also suggests that many times the temple priest and the money changers were working together to defraud the people. These were people living on a very tight margin anyway, and here they've come to the temple to make themselves right with God, and they find priests and money changers working in collusion together. And so when the person or the family would bring an animal for sacrifice, in order to be an acceptable sacrifice, the animal had to be without blemish. It's sad to know that many of the priests examining these animals found blemish upon them. They found blemish upon them, which means they weren't appropriate for the sacrifice, which means the family or the individual had to go out to those selling the animals outside the temple and purchase another animal, which may then be brought in and found to be without blemish. Many of those animals that were found to be unsuitable, that were blemished, were taken around outside back into the stalls of those selling to be sold to someone else. And there was also collusion in the exchange of money. These Jewish people bringing these animals for sacrifice, many of them used Roman coin as part of their everyday lives, but they had to exchange that for Jewish money in the temple, and often those rates were exorbitant, and it was rigged against them. What a racket! You can imagine how this made Jesus angry. He had a right to be angry. It's the same when, in the Gospel of Matthew, this happens. From that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of elders and priests and be killed, and on the third day raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "God forbid it. This must never happen to you." And we all know what happened then. Jesus turned on Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan. You're a stumbling block to me." Well, we understand, don't we? Jesus needs to be faithful unto death. He needs to walk the path of love even to the cross in order to show the people the saving power of love. He can't let Peter's fear or sentimentality or anything else interfere. So we see that Jesus is angry and we say he has a right to be. But for ourselves, we hold ourselves accountable to those earlier chapters in Matthew where Jesus says, "You've heard it said since ancient times, you shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you, if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. You will be liable to hell fire." Jesus' anger is righteous. Ours is reproachable. Or so we think. But what about other instances of Jesus' anger? For example, one we often gloss over because we're paying more attention to what we believe are more important things. This from the Gospel according to Mark. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took with him Peter and James and John and began to be distressed and agitated, and he said to them, "I am deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here and keep awake." And going a little farther, Jesus threw himself on the ground and prayed that if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And Jesus said, "Abba, Father, for you all things are possible. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I want, but what you want." And he came and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "Simon, are you asleep? Could you not keep awake 1 hour? Keep awake and pray that you may not come into the time of trial. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And again he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And once more he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they didn't know what to say to him. And he came a third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? Enough! The hour has come. The chosen one is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up. Let's be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." Enough! Possibly, probably even, I've had enough. Anger. Anger that his needs weren't met. Anger that he was being tested. Anger that it felt as though God had deserted him. Understandable, relatable, forgivable anger. Because it's Jesus. Anger that fueled him toward that mock trial. Anger that gave him courage. Anger that allowed him to drink that cup. Anger that he did not turn inward or turn into physical aggression or passive aggression. Anger that was right-sized and rightly expressed. I realized as I prepared for today that I could have dedicated the entire Lenten series to anger. What it is, what it's not, but I didn't. So what I'd like to do now is simply offer up some thoughts about anger that I hope you will find value in. And pay attention, as they say, to your disturbance. Any disturbance that comes up for you. See if it's disturbance that you can follow and understand and use in your own growth. See if it's disturbance that's outsized or debilitating or shame-inducing or anything that you might want to seek help for, learn more about, talk to a trusted friend about. Okay, some thoughts in no particular order. Anger can help us to say no when we should and can help us to set firm boundaries. Anger can be fuel for a flight or fight or even freeze response. But when we avoid conflict at all costs and bury that anger, it's not healthy. Anger can be the fuel for creativity. When we become so angry at an injustice or a wrong we see in the world that we are propelled to come up with a solution. And our anger fuels our creativity. If we learn to understand and accept our own anger, we can learn to accept it in others so that we can together turn it towards good. Very often when someone seems to be angry, and especially when they're angry with us, we try to fix it immediately or have them calm down immediately. We don't know what to do with it. The anger, sometimes rightly so, makes us feel unsafe, just as our own anger does. And so when anger, a healthy emotion, arises, we don't want to make the space for it. Vince Gauman says that as much as some people like to think otherwise, when people are angry, it's not about feeling better. It's about being better able to feel. In feeling fully, whether it's anger or sadness or joy, he says, we become more alive. In her book about grief, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross writes about the necessity of anger in the grieving process. Anger, she says, is a necessary stage of the healing process. The more you truly feel it, the more it begins to dissipate, and the more you will heal. She says that the truth is anger has no limits, and it extends in your grief to friends, to doctors, to family, even to the loved one who died and left you. And anger can even at that time extend to God. And we demand, where were you, God? Why did you allow this to happen? And underneath that anger, she says, is our pain. our pain at feeling loss, at being deserted, and that pain feels so immense that we feel like we're being tossed about in an endless sea. And when we finally get to anger, anger gives us an anchor to grab hold on, a scaffolding to grab a hold of so that we no longer feel lost in that immense sea of pain and grief. And in that way, our anger is saving, it's centering and orienting. Anger might help you to understand the realities of a relationship. But sometimes when anger is an appropriate response to someone with whom we're in a relationship, we hide and suppress that anger because we're afraid that in expressing the anger, which is right, we might jeopardize the relationship. We might lose the one with whom we are rightly angry. Even worse, some of us have experienced the person with whom we are rightly angry turning the tables on us so that our anger becomes the topic of the fight as opposed to the behavior that brought about our anger. Anger, it's important to understand, is not the same thing as aggression. A lot of people confuse angry feelings with aggression. There are many healthy ways to deal with anger that are not resorting to aggression and threats and violence. Ignoring your anger isn't healthy. Suppressing your anger isn't healthy. Smiling to cover up your anger isn't healthy. Letting others treat you poorly so that you don't have to deal with anybody's anger is not healthy. Suppressing anger and turning it inwards is unhealthy. You must remember that it is possible to, as Paul writes in Ephesians, be angry and sin not. And finally, constructive anger can be focused onto the problem or the situation that we hope to improve and on ourselves and not on the people who are responsible for the situation necessarily. Placing our anger in the right place. I want to end with two challenges to bring compassion to anger-filled situations. To bring compassion to anger-filled situations. You might not be ready for this. That's fine. Don't push yourself, but maybe you are. First, in our supercharged political environment, it seems that anger is all around us, deep enough to drown in. I'm asking you to look at what is happening through a lens of compassion. I'll use myself as an example. It's easy for me to look at Black Lives Matter protesters and have compassion, to have understanding for centuries of violence and oppression, persecution and disenfranchisement that manifest in protest, occasionally even in violence and occasionally aggression. I am casting no blame in their direction, no criticism in their direction. I see it through a lens of compassion, understanding, history. But am I willing to respond to angry people in red hats with the same compassion? Do I absolutely refuse to consider that a man providing for a family of four by living paycheck to paycheck is scared to death that his job on the auto assembly line is going away because the government is going to phase out combustion engines. Am I able to see through a lens of compassion the woman who is abused by her partner, who refuses to wear a mask because it is the only decision she can make for herself and not be punished for? I'm not saying she's right. I'm not saying it's okay. I'm saying, can I look through the lens of compassion? And this pandemic, oh, I'm inviting you to stay very in touch with your own anger and what's behind it. When we grow angry with decision makers, those who seem to stand in the way of what we want and what we need, I'm asking that we look through a lens of compassion and we see the difficult position of those very people that we have asked to make hard decisions for us. I'm asking that we look through their decision making and our interactions through a lens of compassion. I'm asking that we really get in touch with what we're angry at and with whom we're angry. I'm going to end in the same place I started because I think it's the most important. One of the things I learned when I was young is how damaging anger is. I watched adults turn their anger on children, and I learned that anger was hurtful and destructive. I saw the anger of children turned on other children in the schoolyard and learned that anger was hurtful and destructive. I felt the anger of adults and children thrown at me when they perceived I had done something wrong, like accidentally broken something or forgotten to do something I was supposed to do. And I learned that anger was hurtful and destructive, and that anger was bad. And it became the uppermost goal in my life not to be like the angry people. I am luckier than many. For many people, children and adults crushed under the anger of another, learn a different lesson, a crippling lesson. Not that anger is bad, that they are bad. And that evolves into shame and depression and understandably anger. And having learned nothing about anger as an emotion, a value-neutral emotion, they let their anger escape in slow leaks of passive aggressiveness or explosions of rage. And then another person crumples under that anger. And the cycle continues, and we are all wounded by a weapon that, if we could understand it better and work with it instead of trying to master it or eliminate it, another weapon that could be turned into plowshares. Not always, but often enough. Amen.